The Guardian.
The scientists here in Cambridge are going to scan my brain, in particular the activity in this portion, the premotor cortex. That's the part of the brain which gets the body ready to move when you move your arms or your legs. And they're going to ask me to imagine playing tennis in my head.
In 2006, neuroscientists in Cambridge ran brain scans on a young woman who had suffered serious brain damage in a traffic accident. The incident left her in a so-called vegetative state. She slept and woke, but showed no signs of consciousness. What made the research remarkable was that by analysing her brain activity, the scientists found a way to communicate with her.
This extraordinary technique has huge implications for patients who are only apparently in a vegetative state and could be used to involve them in their future treatment decisions and even whether they want to live or die.
9 years later, a report from the UK Parliamentary Office of Science and Technology estimated that as many as 16,000 people in Britain were in a vegetative state. For the best part, they were considered lost, with no way of interacting with the outside world. But the Cambridge research showed that in some cases, at least, there was still hope. But what has become of the research since then? And what are the ethical and legal ramifications for patients who find themselves in this so-called grey zone of consciousness between life and death?
You know, we got this amazing activity. We really couldn't tell the difference between her brain and a completely healthy brain, despite the fact that outwardly she appeared to be entirely vegetative.
And interestingly, the move in the UK now is less towards a complete focus on diagnostic certainty and more towards what would the person themselves want in this situation, with this prognosis, this diagnosis, and this level of uncertainty.
I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
So I will tell you in advance, I just...
Before we get into some of the issues surrounding the ethics and legalities, I wanted to know a bit more about this kind of work. And who better to explain it than the lead scientist on the 2006 Cambridge team?
I'm Professor Adrian Owen. I work at the Brain and Mind Institute at Western University in Canada. I am currently the Canada Excellence Research Chair in Cognitive Neuroscience and Imaging at Western.
Adrian is also the author of Into the Grey Zone, the story of his research into the border between life and death.
Who outwardly might seem completely
I started by asking him what first attracted him to this area.
Formally, I got involved in this area in 1997 when I was introduced to a patient who was in a vegetative state at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge. Her name was Kate. And up until that point, I had no experience, no scientific experience with vegetative state patients. But I had trained in brain imaging, and together with my colleague, David Menon, we decided that let's put Kate into a PET scanner at the time and see what happens, if we can do anything to activate her brain. And obviously the expectation, both for us and for other people at the time, was that we would see nothing. But in fact, Kate's brain responded very well to pictures of her faces of her friends and family.
What is it like, that first moment when you make contact with a patient? Because these patients are generally seen by the medical staff around them as essentially lost to the outside world.
Yeah, so I would say over the years, most of the time, the way it feels is we immediately think, that's great, but what does it mean? And I mean, Kate's a great example of that. You know, we got this amazing activity. We really couldn't tell the difference between her brain and a completely healthy brain, despite the fact that outwardly she appeared to be entirely vegetative. And what does that mean? And you know, does it mean that she's fully conscious and having the same experiences of seeing her loved ones that you and I would in the same situation, or is it some kind of automatic response from her brain? And actually, that's been the theme through 20 years, that's mostly what happens. We get the result, and then we spend a lot of time mulling over what it actually means.
Give us a sense of the technology, the type of approach you take. It sounds like with Kate, you were showing her
images of her family members, friends, to see if there was some kind of recognition. But what are you looking for in the scans?
So there we were really just looking to see whether we could activate her brain. Does her brain have any potential for responding in a normal or a near normal way? And you know, very soon after that, we moved on to things like speech to see whether any of these patients could, whether their brains could decode speech. And we did a whole series of studies in different patients showing that, you know, many of them could, their brains would respond to speech. And then we moved on to, I think, much more interesting ideas to see whether we could really determine that a patient might actually have some level of awareness, you know, awareness of who they were and where they were and the predicament that they were in. And that required a rather different approach to just doing things to people in the scanner. We actually had to get people to do things to themselves. Actually, we had to get people to imagine scenarios that we could then decode and say, yep, we know what that person's thinking. And that's really where I think everything changed.
Using this approach, Adrian and his co-authors showed that of the 23 vegetative state patients enrolled in their 2010 study, 4 could willingly modulate their brain activity. That allowed the patients to answer yes or no to questions by thinking about playing tennis or thinking about walking around their family home.
Hello, Jenny Gipsinger.
It's an incredible finding, and one that raises huge ethical and legal questions.
Hi, Adrian. Nice to...
This is Professor Jenny Gipsinger.
I work at Cardiff University, and I'm co-director of the Coma and Disorders of Consciousness Research Centre.
Jenny joined me and Adrian down the line, and I started by asking her, how does the medical establishment approach these questions?
Well, I think the key principle of informed consent to treatment is one of the key things that medical professionals want to establish. So if there's any way they can establish communication with a patient and find that they have capacity to make their own decisions about treatment, that's always really, really key. So there's a lot of excitement about both the sort of scientific tools that Adrian's developed and his team, and also just tools like, you know, using eye gaze with letterboards or technology that you can use eye gaze to communicate, like Stephen Hawking uses. So the first principle would always be to try and establish communication and informed consent. Problems get more complex when the person has brain damage that means that they legally lack capacity to give consent. So that it may not just be a communication issue, which is the kind of thing that Adrian's highlighting, but it can be more like their brain has been scrambled and they're more like somebody with dementia, for example, even in a minimally conscious state.
Is work like Adrian's having an impact on this area?
Yes. It's sort of mixed in the research that we've been doing with families and professionals in the UK context, in that on the one hand there's obviously excitement and enthusiasm for anything that will improve diagnostic precision and being able to reach and assess what people's level of consciousness and capacity is. On the other hand, there's concern that sometimes the sort of hype that the media can do around such scientific breakthroughs, and of course this is, you know, very exciting and intriguing, can create unnecessary uncertainty, where actually if someone's been brain injured a certain way and they've been in a vegetative state or even a minimally conscious state or perhaps even above that, but you've got a full insight into their level of brain injury, the idea that there's always a scientific discovery around the corner sometimes creates dilemmas for how one responds, especially to someone's prior expressed wishes and beliefs.
I'm wondering if it introduces different levels of consciousness that affect how a patient will be dealt with, you know, the care they have or the decisions around their lives and the consent they can give. Because we know these different terms. We have persistent vegetative state, minimally conscious, locked in. And does the work Adrian's doing and others like him give us new definitions, or is it a whole spectrum? And I'm wondering how that sort of makes it, the implications of that on the sort of ethical issues you have.
I mean, the Mental Capacity Act 2005 kind of defines how you work with patients in the UK. So if you can establish communication and they have capacity, it's their choice. And if you can't, you're meant to follow something called best interests. And interestingly, the move in the UK now is less towards a complete focus on diagnostic certainty and more towards what would the person themselves want in this situation, with this prognosis, this diagnosis, and this level of uncertainty.
Adrian, do we know anything about the quality of life that these kinds of patients have? And are they able to communicate anything around that?
we have several patients now that we've seen in Canada who we've scanned many, many times and asked many questions about the situation they're in, the way they're feeling about the situation they're in. And we, you know, we're more interested in using it as a way of improving their situation, finding out, you know, what TV do they want to watch, what do they like to listen to, these sorts of things. But, you know, some of the time we do get to ask them questions about, you know, if they're in pain, for example, is a very important thing that we push very high up the agenda. But I think actually the work that probably speaks more closely to that question has come from Stephen Laurie's lab in Belgium, where he has interviewed large numbers of patients who are locked in and asked them about their quality of life. And surprisingly, I think for most of us, these patients don't generally report that they would like to die, and they don't generally report the fact that they're unhappy. And the authors of that paper, and I think I agree with this, it sort of interpreted it that probably people are able to recalibrate their lives, you know, given the circumstances that they have. And in that sense, it's reassuring.
The hope is that this work will eventually return a level of autonomy to patients, something we'll hear more about after this break.
How does each individual define for them a quality of consciousness, a quality of life that means they'd want to go through continued life-sustaining treatment or not?
I certainly think this will occur at some point in the next few years, that the right patient will be in the right place at the right time with the right brain scanner, and they will make a decision about what they want to happen to them, and enough people will be convinced that that person has the capacity to make that decision in spite of the fact they have no physical way of expressing it.
We'll be right back. Before we kick off again, I wanted to point you in the direction of another podcast here at The Guardian. It's called Brexit Means, and as the name would suggest, attempts to finally find out what exactly Brexit does mean, apart from, of course, Brexit. So if you feel like delving into the nitty-gritty of Britain's exit from the EU, make sure to join John Henley and his experts on The Guardian's Brexit Means. To find out more, head over to theguardian.com/podcasts or search Brexit Means on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Ian Sample. Before the break, we heard from neuroscientist Adrian Owen about his work into so-called disorders of consciousness. He described a handful of studies that suggested that some of these patients who had been considered unreachable might be able to talk back. The work throws up a number of ethical and legal quandaries, some of which were mentioned by Jenny Kitzinger. We'll hear more about some others later on. But before that, let's hear about a personal connection that Adrian reveals in his new book, Into the Grey Zone. Adrian, your book, Into the Grey Zone, is incredibly moving because of the patient's stories, but also your own involvement with Maureen, the woman you fell in love with in the 80s. How does she come into this story?
I think she's key, because I really don't think I would have ever moved into this area had I not had that relationship. And, you know, this was a person that sometime after a relationship, she had a brain aneurysm that put her into a vegetative state. You know, I really don't think I knew what a vegetative state was at that point. And that sort of, I guess, having that personal experience, you know, I didn't immediately go away and decide I was going to devote the rest of my career to understanding it. But, you know, the fact that within a year, Kate came along, and, you know, I had the technical skills to look at her and put her into a scanner and analyze the data. I suspect I probably would not have done that had I not had the personal experience a year earlier.
Many years later, after you'd done a lot of this work, you ended up coming back to some tests on Maureen to try and understand what levels of consciousness were there in her brain. Tell us about that. What was that like for you?
That was an extraordinary experience. I mean, looking at the brain of somebody that, you know, you have loved in the past, and with the knowledge base that I had at that time, and, you know, by then I'd looked at many, many brains and patients who'd both activated and not activated, and the experience of doing it for somebody that you cared about was quite difficult, I would say.
What's it like to work with people with such serious disabilities? I'm wondering if it changes your own approach to life.
I mean, I think it has. I mean, I very much agree with the last comment that Jenny made. Although personally, for me, it sort of made me realise that, you know, very often things can change, and what we all think we might want to happen to us, you know, if the worst were to occur, might not actually be the way we feel when it does. So I sort of go backwards and forwards with this over from year to year as to whether, for example, I should write an advance directive. Should I say what I want to happen to me if I end up in a vegetative state? And, you know, right now my view is no, because what I want to happen if I end up in that situation is for somebody to put me into a scanner and ask me what I want to happen. And I think, as Jenny said, that, you know, giving people back a voice and having them make the decision in the here and now is what we're all trying to achieve here, because, you know, none of us can know what it's actually like to be in this situation.
I think it's absolutely true that people change their minds, and I think we also have to acknowledge that some people, even when they're in a scanner, will not be able to make that choice themselves. And while that's the ideal, that probably for ourselves and for the people we care about, we'd like them to be able to have the power to make the choice, that's not always going to be possible. And for people with the most profound brain injuries, it's completely different from locked-in syndrome, which in a way I see as a profound physical disability more than a mental disability. But people who are like, if you think of people who've been, you know, injured at birth with oxygen deprivation, that level of consciousness, or people with extreme dementia, you work with them to try and support their choices and empower them. But actually, are there some choices they just can't make? And at that point, we do need to take responsibility for making choices for other people in their best interests. And that's a really hard burden. So personally, I think writing an advanced decision is a really good idea, because it takes that burden off other people. And also, of course, in that advanced decision, you can say, if there's any way of getting me in a scanner and letting me make a decision at the time, obviously do that first. Or just if I seem happy and not in pain, then continue to treat. It's not an either-or, this idea that we might change our minds. You can incorporate that into your advanced decision.
You're steeped in a lot of this thinking as well, Jenny, and I'm wondering whether it has an impact on how you see your life, just as Adrian's work does on his.
I spend a lot of time in care homes with people with profound brain injury, and I value my own freedoms and my own choices hugely, and I'm very conscious of the economic and social context of care. I mean, never mind brain scans. You may be a person can't even be given the right design of call button to press. There were lots of challenges about how we support people to both empower the choices they can make and to improve their quality of life. And unfortunately, the system is rather showing the strain across the board.
It's these kinds of issues that have been so important in recent legal cases, all of which have raised questions over how we define this spectrum of consciousness.
Well, I come at this not from the sort of science of consciousness, but from a sort of ethical moral position about how does each individual define for them a quality of consciousness, a quality of life that means they'd want to go through continued life-sustaining treatment or not. And the most recent case in the UK that's really broken the mold is the Paul Briggs case, where it was very clear in court that he was minimally conscious, that he might even still recover to full consciousness, but his family and his colleagues argued that he would still not want ongoing life-sustaining treatment because nobody thought he'd ever have full capacity to make decisions about medical treatment. And the judge actually ruled that in this case, given the strength of evidence of Paul Briggs' own wishes, the diagnosis itself wasn't that important. We knew he was on the spectrum. There was still time for him to recover, but they still withdrew life-sustaining treatment. And in that sense, the idea that one has to always decide whether someone's conscious or unconscious or be absolutely sure of where they'll end up on a continuum of disability has been disrupted by that.
And do you think that was the right decision?
Yes, I do. I think we have to do everything possible to stop a society that writes off people with disability, or where we assume in any shape or form that certain qualities of life aren't worth living, while also absolutely respecting individuals' own choices. So we had Tony Nicholson in the UK, a campaigner who was locked in, who fought for the right to be helped to die, which he claimed was his right. He lost that case, so he then actually wrote an advance decision, stopped eating, and died of untreated infections in the end. So he made that choice, and I don't think we should take that choice away from anybody.
If this is the case, Adrian, is this issue of how we define the end of consciousness more an academic one, more a scientific curiosity than something that is particularly useful in real life?
I don't think so, because, you know, that we have very real examples where, you know, for example, patients have appeared through multiple clinical examinations by experienced neurologists over decades to have appeared to be entirely vegetative, yet we have shown that they are entirely conscious and actually, with the right technology, could certainly make a decision about what they wanted to happen to them. Now, this is rare, and I don't want anybody to think that this is the case in all patients, but the fact that it exists means that it's not just a scientific question. It can have real-world implications, and I certainly think this will occur at some point in the next few years, that the right patient will be in the right place at the right time with the right brain scanner, and they will make a decision about what they want to happen to them, and enough people will be convinced that that person has the capacity to make that decision in spite of the fact they have no physical way of expressing it. So I do think, you know, for some patients, it does have real-world implications. But, you know, we have to treat each case separately because, obviously, this isn't true of everybody.
In your research, as you've been going through the years, the different patients, you come up against this question when you come out with your results of, yes, but can you prove that this is consciousness or is this an automatic brain response? Do you think you can prove that someone's conscious to everybody's sort of satisfaction or mostly a reasonable satisfaction? Or is, again, that just a bit of an academic issue?
No, I think you can, but it actually took us quite a long time to work out how. And actually, it's pretty simple. I mean, the only way for me to know that you are conscious is for you to tell me that you are, right? If I ask you that you're conscious and you say, yes, I am, you know, there's nothing more I can do to establish that, you know, whether you are or you aren't. And in a sense, that's where we've moved with the brain imaging, rather than just activating brains and trying to understand what it means. We've used these sort of more sophisticated communication techniques to more or less say to the patient, you know, if you're in there, tell us and tell us what it's like. And on that basis, we will assume that, you know, you have a conscious experience of the world that more or less mirrors our own.
As Adrian said, he hopes that this work might one day give a patient their voice back and, in doing so, allow them to make choices about their life. But there's a long way to go.
I think my main feeling about this work is that science and technology is an important part of how we address the challenges around either devastating physical or mental disability, but it is only part of the answer, and I very much want to see that in a more holistic approach, looking at it in terms of economics and social and moral issues and day-to-day care.
And what would that mean, to unpack that a bit?
Well, I think a lot of the research that I have done with families who have somebody with profound brain injuries in a care home, so they were vegetative, they moved into the minimally conscious state, and then they have since become fully conscious. And that's really very common. People do transition over time. Have a lot of battles on their hands about good care for someone with profound mental disability. And the fMRI scanning or work around brain imaging is not answering those problems. So there's a continuum here, and I don't want to fetishize, is someone conscious or unconscious? I think that's really important for locked-in syndrome patients, but less so when you're in a continuum of brain injury.
We've talked a lot about diagnosis today and getting the diagnosis right, but actually I think one of the things that's exciting me is about prognosis. Can we predict, based on these results, say, who is most likely to experience some recovery? And, you know, that's less relevant for the patients that I talk about in the book, because many of them have been vegetative or minimally conscious for many, many years. But of course, in the intensive care unit, where patients are comatose or in the first few days after a brain injury, it's massively important, because that's where decisions are made on a day-to-day basis about, you know, whether to pull the plug, to use the common phrase. And you know, we are now in the process of moving many of these methods into that population of patients, scanning patients in the first few days after a traumatic brain injury or a loss of oxygen to the brain, and trying to predict who is likely to make a recovery and who isn't. Because at the moment, we're using 30-year-old guidelines to make those sorts of decisions. And of course, neuroscience and technology has advanced enormously in that period of time. And I think we can really make a difference there.
Special thanks this week to Adrian Owen and Jenny Kitzinger. We'll include a link to Adrian's new book, Into the Grey Zone, in the episode's description on The Guardian's website. If you've got any questions, queries or feedback, please get in touch via our new email address, scienceweekly@theguardian.com. I'm Ian Sample. This is Science Weekly.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.